When I saw this film with my son, whose name happens to be Miles, we had a blast hearing his name over and over because the protagonist of the movie is Miles Morales. But it was also kind of cool because Miles' policeman father happens to be named Jeff. And I know in my heart that somewhere out there in the Spider-Verse, which is full of endless possibilities, a Jeff probably happens to put on a Spidey suit as well. Howdy, I'm Jeff Goldsmith, and this is the Q&A. My agenda is simple. Each week I plan to bring you in-depth insights into the creative process of storytelling. And how about this, folks? I'm actually wearing a Spidey suit right now because I am podcasting in my Spider-Man underoos. You can Google underoos. It's magical stuff. Nonetheless, folks, this was an absolute blast of an episode for me because I utterly adore today's film, Spider-Man: Into the Spider-Verse. And it was really cool to have co-writer, director Rodney Rothman with me to chat about it. You know, at one point during the podcast, Rodney and I discussed some script pages that were really funny that he shared with us for the article in Backstory Magazine about a scene that was never created but is quite hilarious. And I've decided to share those pages with everybody, so you could just hop on over to backstory.net and you could read those script pages whenever you like. The film is such a fantastic look and continues to pay homage to the history of the beloved character and comic while at the same time doing something new and unique with it, and without a doubt, Rodney was really forthcoming about his creative process, so I know you'll dig this episode. And speaking of things to dig, how's about saving 10% off your application fee at screencraft.org? That's right, the fine folks at Screencraft are dedicated to helping screenwriters and filmmakers succeed, and we are pleased to have them as a sponsor for today's episode. So, you can learn all about the 2019 Screencraft Screenwriting Fellowship at screencraft.org. Past Screencraft Fellowship winners have been hired to write on Netflix shows, sold projects to top studios, and signed with literary agents at top agencies including CAA, WME, UTA, and Paradigm Talent Agency. The Screencraft team is also looking forward to reading your screenplay, because if you're shooting your own film, the Screencraft Film Fund offers up to $30,000 in production financing, not once, but twice a year to emerging filmmakers. All you need to do to save 10% on your application fee is to use promo code QAPODCAST, that's QAPODCAST, all one word, to save 10% on your application fee. And remember, you can learn all about the Screencraft Screenwriting Fellowship and their competitions at screencraft.org. And while you're surfing around online, I hope you also check out backstory.net, where you can read issue 35 of Backstory Magazine, and it features a Vice cover story with writer-director Adam McKay. He takes us behind the scenes in a 4,600-word, spoiler-specific interview all about his truly original script and the making of this fantastic film. In honor of Mission Impossible Fallout hitting home video, good old Christopher McQuarrie shared some of the cool storyboards from the film so you could get an idea of the kind of visual prep he was walking into these sequences with, and I know you'll dig looking at them. Plus, issue 35 also has in-depth articles on Aquaman, Mary Poppins Returns, and our huge Nickel Fellowship piece where we meet the 2018 winners, and in our Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse piece, not only did we interview Rodney Rothman, but also his co-writer Phil Lord, and it's a really fun interview. Plus so much more, so I hope you look at the table of contents so you can see everything that's inside issue 35, and if you like what you see, I hope you consider subscribing. If you're on the fence, you could read issue number 1, the free issue, and test drive us at backstory.net as well, so I hope you'll check it out. And hey, if you're in LA or going to visit LA, make sure to sign up for my screening series so you could come to these events, as we're happy to have you. You could sign up to get on the free email list at backstory.net/events, so I hope to see you at a screening sometime soon. But now, without any further ado, let's jump right onto the stage of the Los Angeles Film School for this sold-out event right after I introduce co-writer-director Rodney Rothman to chat about his latest film, Spider-Man: Into the Spider-Verse. All right. Well, as we're sitting here at the lovely Los Angeles Film School,
Hold on. Nice shoes.
Yeah, I got my Spider-Man Vans on. Kind of love the Marvel Vans. But as we're sitting here at the lovely Los Angeles Film School, I guess the question is, were you formally trained? Did you go to any sort of a film school at all?
Sort of. I went to NYU Film School for a semester.
Really?
Yeah.
Tell me. One semester. Why'd you drop out?
I tried it. It was cool. I learned a lot. I met some cool people at the time. This is a long time ago. At the time, it was a lot of the faculty there were Russian filmmakers, which was kind of cool. Yeah, I learned a lot, but that's about a lot, as long as I stayed.
And so how did you go down your path? I mean, I know that you started writing for Letterman at a certain point. When did you choose writing, and how did you end up writing for Dave Letterman?
And if any of this ever gets boring, can you guys just yell boring at me and we'll switch topics, okay?
Don't. It's fascinating.
I mean, writing kind of found me, quote unquote, in the sense that it was like, I was an okay student, but I wasn't like, I wasn't setting the world on fire. That was something that I got positive reinforcement for when I was growing up. You know, certain specific teachers gave me positive reinforcement for writing, and, you know, or for being funny. You know, that's it's a problem for me to say out loud that funny, because now you're going to be like, he's not that funny.
We just watched your movie. You're pretty funny, Rodney.
Yeah, that's what I got. That's what I got encouragement for. So by the time I was maybe, you know, in high school or, you know, college, I was, you know, I mean, I grew up loving movies, probably like all you guys did. You know, the more I went through life, the more I started to understand that that was a career. It wasn't just something you could like to do. You know, as far as Letterman, it's a long story. It's a long story, but the. The short of it is that, you know, I got into comedy. I got into writing. It's what I was doing in college. I wasn't taking classes in that, and I wasn't getting credit for that. But that's, again, something that I just gravitated towards the stuff that I enjoyed and was good at. Or not good at, but I don't know, just the stuff that, you know, it seemed to be working for me. My mom one Christmas told me she'd met someone who knew someone who knew someone who was a Saturday Night Live writer, a young Saturday Night Live writer, and she gave me this guy's phone number to call up as like an information, just, you know, ask some questions. So I met this guy on the phone, and he told me, this is a long time ago, do you guys know Norm MacDonald? Does anyone still know?
Absolutely, yeah.
So Norm MacDonald hosted Weekend Update on Saturday Night Live, and this guy told me Norm MacDonald buys jokes for $50 a joke, and if you
really,
yeah. So if you send me jokes and I think they're any good, I'll pass them on.
Can I still send Norm jokes?
You
or
could
no?
Probably, okay. You know.
So he could Venmo me, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Right. He wrote me $50. You know, basically, so I started to send jokes in to him, and he started to use them after a while. But it took a while. But he started to use them. He always took the ones that I was sort of embarrassed to send him. I was like, you can't say this on TV, you know. And those were always when he bought it. He would send me $50 checks, and that was how I kind of started. And then. And then the Letterman show was looking to hire, they were looking to hire basically new junior writers to get fresh blood on their staff. And they wanted to call them apprentice writers and pay them a quarter salary. And that was like a plan that they had. And I heard about it through just, you know, someone randomly that I knew was like, hey, I heard about this, and I sent in a submission to them. And it's a really long story about how I got hired. I could tell it if you want, but it's...
Keep going. Okay. You have a little time. You're doing good.
Okay.
I love that it all started with your mom.
Well, okay, but okay, so two points I want to make, because people ask me all the time about, you know, how I got started. It's like, you know, first of all, yeah, my mom said to me, I met someone. And second of all, my break was a result of, like, you know, of weird little things that I'd done because I was interested in stuff, you know? And I got a lucky break, but it was a lucky break that came out of me doing stuff that I wanted, you know, that I was interested in. You know, I met someone here, you know, I was, for instance, like when I, a random person I knew told me about this job at Letterman, you know, just I passed them one day and they were like, hey, you know, if I hadn't passed them that day, I wouldn't have heard about it, you know?
So wait, a complete stranger?
No, not a stranger, but someone who knew me, who liked my writing,
because
I wrote, you know, columns in a newspaper, and they were, you know, into my columns. And I was working at a snack bar at a comedy theater because I like comedy. I was doing it in exchange for classes. And the one of the mid-level producers of this random comedy theater ended up moving out here to LA and becoming an assistant to someone at a management company. But when I sent in my submission to Letterman, this guy who I'd met working at a snack bar sent in my submission to Letterman as if I had representation, which I did not. He was an assistant and he did not represent me.
Fake it till you make it.
Yeah. You know, so again, so it's like, you know, it's a series of weird coincidences or just things, you know. And then the story, you know, so then I got called in, you know, I just sent in a submission and forgot it. You know, I didn't like go to Harvard or anything. I didn't think I was going to get hired by David Letterman.
Most of his staff did. He's not even joking.
Yeah. And I got a call. First of all, this is long enough ago that that actually my sister, my twin sister, forgot for 3 days to tell me I'd gotten a call from the David Letterman show. like a message showed up on her machine, and 3 days later she was like, someone called from, like, someone named Donald from Late Show. I was like, that's the head writer of David Letterman. And, like, you know, so I, you know, I went in for this meeting. I interviewed, like I said, they wanted to hire, writers and pay them less money. And at the end of this interview, he was like, do you want to go meet David Letterman? And I was like, okay. So I got marched down this hallway and down a staircase. And then I got marched into an office. And all of a sudden, I was in an office with David Letterman, sitting at a table. And like, and I'd never, it was literally like, you know, I've talked about it a couple times recently. I haven't really talked about it in a long time, but it was like crossing a weird threshold into television, you know, like all of a sudden, I'd never really met anyone famous before. All of a sudden I was sitting in front of this guy who was by then iconic, you know? And he started asking me questions, and he was much more like kind of, he was cool, he was nice, but he was like much more low energy than he is on TV. And you know, at the time I was working at MTV, I was like a glorified intern, you know. I worked in the development department. I got paid nothing, you know, but I had this job that I'd gotten. And he said, I hear you're working at MTV. What are you working on there? And just that day, I'd been told by my boss at MTV, just so you know, you work on secret stuff. It's like top secret proprietary stuff. We don't talk about it outside the building. It's like, you know, people are trying to rip it off and stuff. So then David, you know, like later that day, David Letterman was like, what are you working on? And in my head, like my paranoid, weird brain, I was like, oh, maybe he knows you're not supposed to talk about this stuff. And he's like testing my loyalty. So I was like, you know, well, sir, you know, just like shows and stuff, you know, just like, you know, we're just like working on shows. He says, what shows? And I said, well, you know, shows with comedians, and we could work on some game shows. And Dave Letterman, like, you know, it's like an interviewing talent he has. He just starts to, like, find the story, you know? He's like, which comedians are you working with? What game shows are you making? And I started to panic. And I was like, sir, I have to be honest. I just asked me today not to talk about this stuff, and I feel strange talking about it. And he kind of nodded, and then he just changed the subject, and he asked me other questions for a couple minutes. The whole thing didn't last more than 4 or 5 minutes. And then at the end of the interview, he kind of was like, all right, it's nice to meet you. I'm going to ask you one more time what you're working on at MTV. And then I like told him everything. Like, I like stayed for another 5-10 minutes and just told him everything proprietary we were working on in like a one spew. And then I left, and then I got hired.
Do you think he would have hired you if you hadn't?
I don't know. You know, later on, I was like, maybe he was like testing my loyalty to him. You know, like, you know, for
it. I can see that. Yeah. I can see that. You know, Super Dave Osborne just died, and he was on Letterman many times. Did you ever have a chance to meet him? Do you have any Super Dave Osborne stories? If any of you don't know who Super Dave Osborne is, please look him up on YouTube. You could find him quite a bit out there.
Yeah, I'm going to bum you out. I don't think I have any Super Dave Osborne.
That's okay.
I must have seen him as a guest a whole bunch of times, but yeah.
When you stopped writing for Letterman and you transitioned into fictionalized television, Undeclared was your big break in 2001. And I'm just curious, what was your biggest lesson from that, from writing narrative with characters now rather than just jokes and skits?
I mean, the biggest lesson when I made that transition, so I'd been working on this like late night comedy show, you know, this was 15, 17 years ago, and then I moved to this TV show. But honestly, the biggest lesson was that writing narrative scripts is hard, you know? You know, like, and I was pretty cocky, you know, and it was just hard. I just started this job, and I realized very quickly I had no idea what I was doing. I was working with, I was 25 at that time. I was working with an 18-year-old Seth Rogen, who was a writer on the show, and was amazing writer, 18-year-old writer. Like, would just, and he would just, like, you know, he would just like vomit out scripts literally in like an hour, you know, while high. And like, they were so good. And so that was, you know, in addition to feeling like I wasn't any good at it, there was the added problem then of an 18-year-old who was, you know, a genius doing it. I felt better when he got really famous. You know, I was like, oh, okay, well, at least the person that, you know, I was ashamed to work with turns out to be one of the best writers, you know, around, you know.
But you jumped into it.
I did.
Jumped into it. Yeah. I want to skip forward, you know, to 2013, your feature debut, live action. It was a grudge match with Stallone and De Niro, both of which who had been in boxing movies in their own right. Yes. And you were co-writing on it. What was your biggest lesson from that feature film experience?
Well, that wasn't my first... My first feature experience was this movie, Forgetting Sarah Marshall. I worked as a producer.
Right,
writer.
Sorry, I mean as a credited writer.
I worked as a producer slash writer on a whole bunch of movies before that, but I was always credited as a producer.
Right.
And then Grudge Match, I didn't work on. I mean, I did work on it, but like, you know, whereas on the other movies, I was on set and was. You know, super.
So you were doing like punch up type stuff.
I did a couple drafts of it. You know, it turned out that movie turned out really good, and it was a really good experience. When I did that job, I didn't think they were ever going to make it. You know, because they were like the premise of that movie is two boxers in their 60s who like used to be, you know, arch enemies, you know, arch rivals, you know, have a rematch in their 60s, like 30 years later. And I did it as a job. It was really, I liked the people I was working with. I didn't think it was going to get made because I was like, there's only like four actors who could be in this movie. And Sylvester Stallone can't play another boxer than Rocky, you know, and like, you know, Robert De Niro, you know, like I just, but they ended up literally getting Sylvester Stallone and Robert De Niro to do it.
Just going back for a second, what kind of writing did you do on Sarah Marshall? Like in other movies, would you just kind of add to the jokes? Like punch up type things? Because I mean, obviously WGA credits are very difficult, and
right.
You didn't end up credited on any of those.
I didn't, but I was a writer of record on those movies.
Okay,
I just you know, basically what happened is I went to work on this show Undeclared with Judd Apatow before he was Judd Apatow, and. That was in like the early 2000s, and as Judd started to move into movies, he basically started to take the TV model and how we were making TV shows and bring it to movies. So very writer driven, writers running sets basically. So the director of Sarah Marshall, I worked on Get Him to the Greek with him. I worked on a movie called 5-Year Engagement, you know, but all those movies of that era, Superbad,
right.
All of them were made in this way where there were writers, you know, so I basically started on Forgetting Sarah Marshall, you know, maybe 5 months before shooting and was there every day of production and kind of worked with the director and Jason Segel as an onset creative supervisor, kind of, and creative producer, essentially. So, and that was a big Judd innovation, I guess, and the community that I worked with at this show Undeclared, which lasted for 18 episodes, and some people remember, but you know, it's to be generous.
I wish they had more than 18 episodes.
Right, but yeah. To be generous, it was a cult show, but a lot of people from that show like ended up kind of taking over comedy. You know,
oh yeah, absolutely.
You know? So that very writer driven. You know, it's a whole approach to making movies and to making comedies that has to do with, among many other things, it has to do with writers being in positions of authority, and it's their job and as producers, and it's your job to kind of try to anticipate all the problems you might have in edit and try to solve all the problems while you're shooting. You know,
you worked with Lord Miller on 21 Jump Street.
I did.
And so what was something that you observed about their process? And then we're going to get to Spider-Man, I promise.
Yeah. So by then I started, you know, when I started to work on Jump Street stuff and when I started to work with Phil Lord and Chris Miller, I was starting to move. I'm interested in all of it, but I was starting to move from like pure, really fun comedies. I was starting to get a lot more interested in visual storytelling and in like, you know, becoming more, you know, adept at that, and I just had a lot of ideas, you know, about that, and Phil and Chris, who I'd known for a while, that was like their superpower, was, you know, in some ways taking some of the voice or tone of like a Judd type movie and then marrying it to like extraordinary visual storytelling and visual joke telling and, you know, and just...
And in the case of that, and into a pre-existing franchise.
Yeah.
You know, because they were kind of bringing their voice and literally jacking into a world that was previously existing, but giving it their own spin, which I thought was cool.
Yeah, yeah. Using these platforms to kind of just freestyle on a on something different, you know? So, yeah.
So when did you guys, when did you first become involved with Spider-Verse? What were your first talks?
I first got involved about maybe about 3 years ago. It you know, it unfolded kind of in stages. It was in development for 3 or 4 years. So I initially came on as a writer to help out for a couple months. And then I went off of it for a few months. And then I came back as a writer. And within a couple weeks of that kind of second go-round, I was asked to... step up and be a co-director of the movie with a couple people who were already doing it, who really wanted to be here tonight, but couldn't because they just they blew it. I mean, they didn't care, you know.
You're of course talking about
we're
Bob
recording
and,
this, right?
Bob and Peter,
yeah,
yes,
yeah, Bob, yeah, Bob and Peter. I mean, they just you know.
Peter, we were told Peter came down with
Peter's sick.
He's sick.
He's legit, legit sick.
And Bob had, fled to Canada. No,
no, Bob. I mean, the real reason is Bob has family stuff. He has family stuff.
It's totally cool. It's totally cool.
But yeah, so this movie was really hard, you know.
but you know, and we're gonna have a spoiler section. But I just want to ask a question about when you came on originally. Mm-hmm. Was Miles Morales gonna,
gonna
be the lead from the beginning?
From the beginning, it was. You know,
so Sony had no problem with that, with really branching out, because that's something about this film that's great.
Yeah. That was from the very beginning. The roots of this movie about 4 years ago are Amy Pascal, who is one of our producers, and who has worked on all the Spider-Man movies, and at the time was running Sony. She had a relationship with Phil and Chris and asked them if they had this idea of doing an animated Spider-Man movie. It was just, you know, they were looking for just interesting ways to go at Spider-Man. And they asked Phil and Chris. Phil and Chris essentially said no.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, they loved Amy and they loved Spider-Man, but they said no. But thought about it for a bit. And they ended up coming back to Amy and saying that they could be interested. But for starters, you know, it would have to be about Miles. And who had been introduced in 2011, and this was like maybe 2015, 14. I think they saw the potential for like it being, again, it being a platform to try out some pretty experimental notions. Nothing was really figured out at all, so it's very vague, but, you know, a way to sort of try some notions in animation and in visual storytelling, and they basically were like, we want to do about Miles, and we want it to be crazy. And they said yes, and then they had to actually put the movie together.
A question about that. I'm curious, and it could just be a coincidence, but in 2010, there was a video game called Spider-Man Shattered Dimensions, mm-hmm. which had a multiverse with Spider-Ham, with normal Spider-Man, with mm-hmm. Spider-Man Noir, and like an 80s version of Spider-Man. Was that at all an influence or any of the Spider-Verse comics?
That what you're talking about was not an influence on us. None of us had seen that. This is actually, I think it's the first I've ever heard of that. But there is a series of Spider-Verse comics by, you know, by Dan Slott and by other people. And they very well may have been influenced by that.
Okay,
yeah,
that makes sense. I want to talk about your habit for a second, then we'll kind of get into the spoilers of the movie.
Okay.
When you sit down to write, how important is outlining to your habit?
It's pretty important, but it's... I mean, I don't know, but I mean, how many of you guys are writers? I'm just curious. A lot of... Okay, here we go. So,
good show of hands.
You know, like, my habits are pretty neurotic. You know, like, it's
There's no one way to do it, so tell us. What do you do that's neurotic?
I mean, and they've gotten more neurotic as I've gotten more experienced. Neurotic maybe isn't the right word, but like I do outline, but it's like I found that I do this like very productive procrastination these days, you know?
Happens to a lot of people.
Yeah, yeah.
What's your favorite way to procrastinate?
Well, I don't. Well, of course, I like. I mean, the internet is a nightmare for me.
I've heard of it.
You know, I have this whole thing. Personally, I don't know about you guys, but personally, like, I write. I always every project I work on, I have to relearn the same lessons. It's always a process of relearning the same lessons and thinking that it's going to be different this time, and then it's not. You know, always every time, and I tend to work in coffee shops. I tend to leave my phone in my car. I tend to turn the internet off or work places where I have no access to the internet. That's after sometimes weeks of like, I can work in my office or I can, you know, I can work with the internet. You know, this time is going to be different.
Do you feel being out in public in a public place also helps you focus because you're around other people? You don't want to be diddling off,
wasting time. Yeah, and everyone's different, you know, and some people I know are really good at writing, you know, in cloistered environments, and that's cool for them, you know. I have to be normal in public. I have to be normal. If I'm by my, like, privacy is bad for my writing. Unless I have such a crazy deadline and, like, I'm, like, jacked on coffee and I gotta, like, just, you know, write a shit ton in like 3 days. Then all bets are off, and I'm running on adrenaline, and I'm not, you know. But for normal writing, yeah. I go through these like I'm working on something right now. It's like I'll like do research. I'll make notes. I'll draw weird maps of ideas and like diagram the story in some weird way that only I understand.
Sorry to geek out. Are you talking about diagramming story beats? Is that something that you like to do? Because a lot of writers do stuff like that.
I do, but it's like more freeform than that. And it's like in my own crazy language. You look at my notebooks and I look like a crazy person. But it kind of makes sense to me. And it's often a process of like almost rewriting. I also have like memento problems with my brain where like every day I wake up and I don't remember what I did the day before or what I'm writing. And I almost have to like redo everything.
Remember Sammy Jenkins.
Yeah. It's all crazy. But it kind of works for me. You know, and it helps me write things that are, you know, richer for me and have different connections. I find connections in what I'm writing.
Well, you co-wrote this with Phil Lord. So,
yeah.
So did you guys break an outline together at a certain point and then split off? How did that work?
No. With this, Phil wrote the first draft and...
Oh, so you came into a script that was pretty much mapped out to an extent.
The bones of it were mapped out, and the bones of it in a lot of ways didn't change, but a lot of other stuff, you know, I mean, animation in general is a really collaborative, iterative process, like literally like hundreds and hundreds of drafts, you know, constantly putting scenes up on their feet. You know, you have storyboard artists, you have audio, you know, scratch audio recordings, or you're recording with the actors, you're editing boards, you know, countless painful screenings of the movie, deeply painful screenings of the movie.
Animatics, yeah.
Animatics.
And we'll talk about that a little later in the spoilers when we can, because I want to hear about what changed.
But
so you came on to Phil's draft, and then you did a rewrite, essentially?
Yeah, there was a 170-page draft. Phil had gone to England to work on Solo. They were figuring out the story still. They were very early in the script and story process. They had this one script that they could storyboard to, but they had very quickly reached a point where they needed to figure a lot of stuff out.
For Spider-Verse. Yes.
Yeah, and that's when I came in.
And so how long until your first draft after you kind of did a rewrite on it?
I did one draft in about 3 weeks. When I'm doing like a deadline, you know, production job, I often can't afford to do my neurotic stuff, you know, although I still do kind of, but just in a much more accelerated version of it.
All right, because I'm going to really want to hear what was in that first draft. But so just on your habit again, do you give yourself a page count to hit each day, or do you go for a certain amount of hours?
I go for a certain amount of hours, kind of. Like, I try to get – I have two kids now, so, you know, all bets are off. But, like, I try to get working – again, this is just me – as early as I can in the day. I work all day. I don't work all day. But I, you know, but I, you know, I give myself from, you know, 8 if I'm lucky, 9 in the morning till I usually go home at around 5:30 or 6.
Okay.
And then if I'm in like, usually I fall behind. I always fall behind. Always. So then I have to start to really cram towards the end. Every project sucks. Every project, I tell my wife.
The passion.
Yeah. I like panic on every project and tell my wife that it's a disaster and that, you know, if I happen to be working on a real thing, I'm like, I'm taking Jump Street down. I'm taking Spider-Man down, you know, and I mean it. Like, I'm in a panic, and every time my wife says, you say that every time, and every time I say this time is different, and I mean it, and I always, I'm not saying this is always going to happen or it's always, like, genius, but I always have, like, a breakthrough at some point, you know, towards, it's like all the pain and all the generation of material, and then in one big spur at the end, I usually, like, just grab shit and start to connect wires and start to write stuff new that feels really fresh and take old stuff and patch that in. And that's how I make the thing that I show people.
What do you do if you get writer's block? How do you battle it if you get it?
I definitely get writer's block, but me, I get out a pad. You know what? I've gotten better with writer's block. I get out a pad and I start to write on a pad. And I don't even write, like, real scenes. Like, I might even write shorthand and, like, write a little scrap of a line and write, like, do a little arrow or write what I want it to be. I might do that on the script, you know, if I'm in final draft. I stop putting it in script form and I start just putting it down the side. You know, what I find myself, what I do is I take away the pressure that it has to look like a script or it has to be, you know, polished. I just make it, like, pieces and chunks, and I get the shape of a scene down, or, you know, I write it long, and then after that's down, I might go through and write the scene off of that.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
You were almost skipping over it earlier, but it's kind of a big deal to suddenly be named co-director.
Yeah.
And this is your feature directorial debut, technically.
Yeah.
How did that come about? Tell us the conversation when you realized you weren't just going to be writing it.
They asked me if I wanted to co-direct it, and I think by then, I secretly wanted them to ask by then. You know, I'd seen very early, like, VizDev, we call it, like, very early, you know, visual development, artwork, and, you know, the production designer, Justin Thompson, plans for what this movie was going to look like, and it was really early. But I remember sitting in a room with him and looking at some of this early stuff, and first of all, I was like, this is cool as hell. You know, this is what I've been looking for. Like, you know, just a really ambitious, risky, you know, artist-driven vibe. And I also was getting inspired in terms of writing. You know, I was starting to get a sense of what is really cool about animation, which is that you're in this awesome feedback loop with multiple departments at the same time where you can... You have artists working and, you know, a storyboard artist, anyone might just make a piece of art, you know, that inspires something, you know, someone might draw a sound effect, you know, in a piece of concept art in a cool way where it's integrated into the shot in an unexpected way. And then you're like, oh, yeah, like we can do that. And that can be, okay, so how do I like thematically tie that into the movie? Like, how do I, you know... And it's like that for years. It's really exciting. And I was coming off of some pretty unsatisfying experiences trying to get ambitious projects off the ground and hitting walls.
As a co-director, tell us about the style, because it's really fascinating. You're doing hand-drawn over 3D animation, which mm-hmm. is computer-generated, which is wild because that means you're scanning film in and out. You're integrating the dot matrices of the mm-hmm. pages of comic books. You're integrating the blur of the three-color printing. Mm-hmm. And there's so much going on. I'm curious, was there a thematic edge to it? Because mm-hmm. sometimes I noticed some of that stuff early in Miles' origin story, and as he was evolving, the look was evolving as well. Mm-hmm. But tell us about the style, because the style in this film is really stunning.
Yeah, I mean, there's a, you know, as far as the visual style, there's a bunch of things going on. It's a mix of a lot of influences, you know, comic books and animation and cinema and street art and all kinds of stuff. Everything, we try to do everything from a story and character place. So, and sometimes you can reverse engineer that. Sometimes the idea comes, the cool idea comes first, and then you're like, how can we make this right for us? The goal from the beginning was to try to do something really new and immersive in terms of the visual storytelling and the cinematic experience, you know. So, and it took years, you know, a year and a half to make the first couple seconds or like 3 seconds of the movie.
Really?
Yes. And then it took a year and a half to make the rest. Or we had a year and a half to make the rest. But, you know, but certain ideas came forward, you know. You know, a big thing is like, how do we transpose things from comic books to cinema? And it's not just because we want it to be like a living comic book. It's because we're trying, you know, part of the sort of like pretentious goal was we're like, we want to recreate what it feels like to read a comic book or to read, you know, the way you have this intimate experience with a comic book, or you can like look at different things, or so certain rules emerge. Like, okay, we can express lighting in this movie with Benday dots. You know, these dots. You know, if you look closely at a 70s or 60s comic book, you see these dots. You know, it comes from this assumption that an audience, if it makes sense, you know, an audience can get used to anything. You know, in the first couple minutes of your movie, you're laying down your rules visually, and the audience can go with you. And that was a big gamble for us, you know. And we don't do depth of field in the movie. We do color separation. You know, we take color separation, a version, again, from comics. Thematically, where we ended up was we said, we like the idea of taking mistakes from comic books and making them part of the visual language of the film.
Right, things would blur. Objects sometimes would
mistakes,
blur.
Printing mistakes, you know. Or printing limitations, you know, because we felt that that was expressing Miles' story in a way, and was expressing a story about art and about a budding artist and about someone who needs to make a lot of mistakes and learn from their mistakes. And we just started to try to make these connections, and we rolled the dice that it would work.
It definitely worked. How did you split up time as directors between Bob and Peter? Would sometimes one of you be doing a voiceover session while someone else is storyboarding, while someone else is supervising it, you know, VFX?
That's what it was. So we had three directors. We really did. And we had Phil and Chris, who were super involved, you know?
Of course.
So we had a lot of people, you know. It's like I said, we had a year. I mean, this is a really complicated movie. You know, to story's complicated. It's, you know, the imagery is complicated. There was a lot to figure out as far as building the tools we needed to build to make it. We were like, it was a shit show, you know? Like, at a certain point, we were like deeply in the weeds and in danger of not finishing the movie. And when you're working on a Spider-Man movie for like a major studio, they're not into the, we're not going to finish the movie.
Right, and you had a Christmas release date, basically.
Yeah.
So that wasn't, you can't out of that.
So it was all hands on deck. And, you know, so like Bob and Peter, my co-directors, you know, we all brought different areas of expertise into it. You know, they, you know, have a lot more, you know, Peter is a legendary, he started in this business as a legendary storyboard artist, like truly the best, like, you know.
Peter did storyboards for Fight Club. Peter did storyboards for tons of great movies.
Yeah. Like name drop. I once years ago asked Spike Jones, I wanted to hire a storyboard artist.
Right.
I asked Spike Jones to recommend a storyboard artist. And he recommended Peter Ramsey.
Peter did Being John Malkovich and Adaptation.
Yeah. And Bob, you know, has, you know, he started in like 2D animation. And, you know, I wish he was here so you could just see what a scruffy mess he is. Like, he's just, you know, he's just like punk rock. Like, he's like, he lives, you know, all of us do. Like, it was a passionate crew of people that, you know, went after each other a lot. So we all brought these little areas of expertise, but to make it work, we had to kind of joined forces, and we had to have like the same goal in mind, you know, and we did, you know, and we did, like, you know, we had this shared goal as far as wanting to like make something. I mean, we wanted to make something that would visually melt people's brains a little bit, you know. That's what we wanted to do. You have to decide to do that because no one's gonna let you, you know. And we, you know, and then story-wise, we wanted it to be like it's all about Miles and his family, and we wanted it to be really emotionally interesting. And we wanted to test out some theories about how about performances and animation and how naturalistic they could be, or how, you know. Anyway, so yeah.
What was the budget and schedule?
The budget was about $90 million. Is that what you asked?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
And the schedule?
Never ask a lady her age, man. the schedule, in what sense?
How long did it take from beginning to end, would you say? You said about 3 years?
Yeah, I mean, it took 3 or 4 years, but we basically made the movie in a year and a half.
Okay. Last question before we dive straight into the spoilers. You start the movie off with the comic books code. Mm-hmm. And, you know, for some people that implies censorship.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Stan Lee himself had to fight against them when he brought up Iron Man's alcohol abuse.
Mm-hmm.
What was your thinking on the comic books code, like, logo starting off in the movie? Or was it just like a nod to Days Gone By?
Yeah, we just thought it was cool.
Okay, that's kind of where I thought it was going to be. Not a big thing about censorship. All right, so we're getting into our spoilers. Podcast listeners, if you have not seen Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse, please press pause and come back because we're going down it fast. You said that you had this 3-week epiphany on your draft. Mm-hmm. And you said you had a breakthrough. So now that we're in the spoiler section, what was your breakthrough? What really kind of got you in as a writer for Spider-Verse that you weren't seeing before that moment?
I'd say the big epiphanies were that it was, I mean, maybe it seems kind of obvious, but the big epiphany was that it was all about Miles and his family, you know, and that almost, and that the Miles, his dad and his uncle triangle was the core or the heart of the movie, you know, and Miles himself, you know, and, you know, subjectively trying to tell the story of a kid, you know, a 13-year-old who is confused and stuck between different worlds, and to try to express that. That we had so many ideas in this movie, and, you know, and so many characters, and, you know, so many things going that. Weirdly took, you know, not to say it took me, but it's like, that was one of the things that I kind of came in really, championing, was just like, make this stuff work and then worry about the crazy stuff.
At what point did you realize you were going to have the death of Peter Parker so early on?
That was when I got there.
Okay.
And that was something from the comics. That's from Miles comics.
Of course. I mean, yeah. I just, you know, when you're getting into this multiverse Spider-Verse, you could have gone any way. Yeah. So I was just curious when that entered the sphere and if you were going to continue that, obviously, because, you know, here it's tied directly to, you know, turning on the device and the battle with Goblin and Kingpin.
Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah, we changed a few things, but it basically is a version of what is in the comics. And yeah, we just anything that seemed provocative and, you know, crazy and we shouldn't be doing it, we tended to try to do it.
Well, it's great because, like, you know, Peter Parker, the one that dies, I'm talking about, Parker 1, he literally is inside the beam, which is what calls the other spider people from the other verses, the other five, you know, to make them five, sorry. But he's literally in the beam. But, you know, we still don't know what's going on. And something that I thought was really well done here was you spent a lot of time developing Miles and his family. You know that Kingpin's after something, but you don't know what.
Mm-hmm.
At what point did you want to reveal Kingpin's goal, which is to revive his dead wife and son? When did you have the decision of having them killed? Because, I mean, it's just interesting as a thing to do, as his drive, you know, in which he's literally trying to revive them. He's using their DNA to try and bring them back for a second second chance. Mm-hmm. And as a character arc, it's really interesting because it doesn't matter how many times or how many different ways he brings them back. At the end of the day, he's a bad guy that they would never respect once they learn that secret in this version.
Well, yeah, well, I mean, maybe somewhere out there, you know, somewhere out there, there's some version, you know,
where they love it, sure.
Yeah, yeah. But
it is the metaverse.
That I guess that came in about a year and a half ago, you know, and where.
So it wasn't always there.
It was not always there. When I got to the movie, that wasn't there. That was one of the early things that I worked on with everyone, was trying to figure out something interesting for Kingpin that seemed thematically connected to everything that was going on.
Were you going to have anything about the spider that bites Miles? I mean, we see on it, it has 42, mm-hmm. it has the logo.
Everything in the movie, any question you have was, you know, considered, discussed, fought over.
Of course.
In some cases, maybe even animated.
I want to hear about those things.
You know, the spider, we definitely have, there definitely is a story behind that spider. I think it can be figured out.
Of course.
Yeah, you know, relatively.
But was it something that you really were going to put in his origin story per se, of showing it? And
it was.
Was it animated?
That wasn't animated, but it was, we definitely had it in. You know, when you make a movie like this, you know, I mean, first of all, you're trying to get it down to like a manageable time, especially if you're like in the weeds, you know.
This is a fast 2 hours. I got to give you credit for that.
But you know, but it's always, one of the cool things about making a movie and like whittling it down is this process of figuring out what doesn't need to be said, you know. And I'm not saying we got everything right with that, but.
You definitely did.
But yeah, it's like, you know, it's, that's a scary part of making a movie, is letting go of the things you think are critical to say. And believe me, we said everything. Everything you could say at some point in this movie, we said it, you know?
Well, I want to talk about those left turns for a second. You know, I published Backstory and we interviewed you for it with mm-hmm. Phil. And I always love left turns and stuff mm-hmm. like that. And you guys, your team and Sony were very kind to give us a deleted little scene about a different Spider-Man that was at one point a dream of yours to have in the movie, Australian Spider-Man.
Australian Spider-Man.
And we published that. Do you want to give us the pitch for Australian Spider-Man?
Sure.
Because we're going to take those script pages and we're going to put them on our site so people could see them.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and it's part of the article. I love it. I think it's hilarious.
Dream come true for me. Not a dream of mine. Like, I would, you know, I wrote so much of this movie so fast and so late at night and under such insane pressure. Like, because there's like hundreds of people, they're just spending money, and there's hundreds of people that are like literally waiting for me to show up with pages, you know?
No pressure.
Terrifying. And it's like that for months and months. So I was working on one of many iterations we had of the scene where they get to Aunt May's and they meet the spiders. And
in the cave.
Yeah.
Sorry, the spider shed.
In the cave, yeah. And Phil and I, you know, we always had this pet idea that we wanted a lot more spider people in the movie. Like, we wanted like 50 more to show up, which would have been funny and cool. But once you reach a certain point in production, like, it stops being funny to production when you add any new ideas. Anything that requires them to do anything that they don't haven't already built an asset for, they call it, you know, or that they
assets meaning sets, costumes, characters.
Yeah, yeah, and lots of assets can be repurposed in different ways. You know, you can like, you know, retexture or repaint, you know, whatever. You can get real creative. But so I was writing this scene, and I, you know, we were trying to figure out a bunch of things at that time. We were like, how do we build stakes? How do we around here? How do we, you know? So I just, on a whim at like 2 a.m, added this character, Australian Spider-Man, to the group you saw, and he just showed up and started. He was just Australian and very upbeat, and he's, you know, he had gotten there a day earlier because he was from Australia, so he had gotten there a day earlier than everyone else, and then he started to glitching, and then he started glitching in front of, and then he like very disgustingly glitched to death in front of everyone, and like glitched into a puddle on the floor and just died. This lovely upbeat character, and then everyone just like stared at his dead body, and then they were like, "We have a day to live." Like,
well, because it was, you know, playing with the stakes of the 24 hours.
Yeah, and they were like, "We have 24 hours to live because Australian Spider-Man just died."
Right, and he got there a day ahead of everyone.
Yeah, ahead of everyone else.
I love everything about it.
Yeah, it was pretty funny.
It pains me that it's not.
I thought
movie.
It was pretty. pretty funny. When I wrote it, I was like, I'm a genius. I like...
You are, sir.
Yeah, no, but I was like, this is like the funniest thing that has ever happened. And no one thought I was funny. Phil, that's not true. Phil thought I was funny. Phil wanted to do it. Phil always wants to do the thing that makes people mad. Yeah, but they were just like, this is like, you're demonstrating a profound lack of understanding of how movies are made right now by handing this in and then like mic dropping and walking and going home and going to sleep, you know?
but serious question, it would have required one new character to be built, which I know is huge. I'm not trying to undermine what that is, but they were already in that set. They were already all there.
You're right.
So was it really just the addition of a character? That was what killed him.
And I'm sure I made a feeble attempt at making that argument. They were like, it was like a humorless time in the production.
Okay. When was it? When was the humorless time? Was it right in the middle when everybody was deep in it?
That was probably like within the last year, certainly.
Okay.
That was, I don't know. I mean, we're in January, so that was maybe in March.
Okay.
Yeah.
March of 18?
Yeah.
Folks, I'm jumping in really quick to pitch you about what's in the latest issue of Backstory Magazine, but before I do, I can't believe it's already been a year since we launched the desktop laptop version of Backstory Magazine over at backstory.net. You asked for it, and I took forever to build it, but finally triumphed over the technological limitations to bring you Backstory in all its glory on desktops and laptops so you can experience our awesome art direction, interactivity, and in-depth interviews. So I hope you'll support us by purchasing a single issue or a subscription at backstory.net. If you've never read us, I hope you check out the free issue over there, which is a double issue filled with great content. You can, of course, read us on Google Play, on an Android tablet, or via our iPad app where it all started. And the great news is, if you subscribe at backstory.net, your login will work on all those devices. So I hope you consider digging in. Another reason why now is the perfect time to subscribe is because we just released issue 35 of Backstory with our Vice cover story. That's right, we have got a fantastic interview with writer-director Adam McKay on all the wild structuring and non-traditional writing he did on Vice. Plus, since it's Christmas, although we already did a very cool Die Hard podcast that you've probably heard by now, co-writer Stephen E. D'Souza wanted to share what he considers to be the most complete version of his Die Hard screenplay, and the only place you'll find it is in issue 35. It's 133 pages long and has all the different shooting draft color pages, so you will definitely want to check that out. Backstory issue 35 also features our huge Nickel Screenwriting Fellowship piece, where we interview this year's fellows and run excerpts from their scripts. In honor of Mission Impossible Fallout hitting home video, good old Christopher McQuarrie shared some of the cool storyboards from the film so you could get an idea of the kind of visual prep he was walking into these sequences with, and I know you'll dig looking at them. And in our Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse piece, not only did we interview writer Rodney Rothman, but also co-writer Phil Lord, and it's a really fun interview. Even cooler, since Rodney was kind enough to supply us with the script pages of his unused and hilarious Australian Spider-Man concept, you could read them in the magazine as an excerpt, and we're also putting them up there for everyone to see as a blog post at backstory.net, so you could read them there even if you're not a subscriber. Plus, we've got a huge spoiler-centric Aquaman article featuring the film's co-writers, a Mary Poppins Returns piece with writer David McGee, writer-director Barry Jenkins chats about if Beale Street could talk. You could read a full Blacklist screenplay and a full Bloodless TV pilot, plus interviews with each of those respective writers. We also interviewed Mystery Science Theater 3000's creator Joel Hodgson and director Rob Schraub about making this season's The Gauntlet. And speaking of schlock cinema, we've got the writer-director of the newly uncovered silly ass-kicking flick Ninja Zombie. Yes, it's a lost film, and it is exactly what it sounds like. A ninja, who's also a zombie. And there's so much more in issue 35, I'm not even doing it justice, so I hope you will check out the table of contents over at backstory.net. Look, it really means a lot to me to have my podcast listeners support my passion project, so thanks for considering. Of course, don't forget to visit our sponsor, the fine folks at ScreenCraft, and save 10% off your application fee at screencraft.org by using code QAPODCAST, all one word, QA podcast at screencraft.org, and you could save 10% on your application to the ScreenCraft Film Fund, or even a chance to win the ScreenCraft Screenwriting Fellowship and sign with a top agency. So don't forget to type in QA podcast at screencraft.org to save 10% when you apply. But now let's jump right back into my chat with co-writer, director Rodney Rothman to chat about his passion project, Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse.
Tell us some of the other left turns, like other things you considered other than 50 spider people. Did you ever consider more villains, more antagonists for any reason?
No. I'm trying to think of left turns.
Just things that never got animated, that were ideas that for a while it's like, yes, we're totally doing this. Not Australian Spider-Man, mm-hmm. which died a quick death.
This is not interesting at all, but I'm just kind of going through the thing. I wrote a like a Hasidic character in Miles' neighborhood named Herschel that I had this dream that either Action Bronson or Mike D would play. I basically cast Mike D.
Wow.
And no one wanted to put Herschel in the movie but me. But he was in a lot of storyboards, and he now is like he's like in one shot.
What was Herschel's function?
I don't know, man. I just wanted to put Action. I thought Action Bronson, no function. He was not in the movie. I just thought Action Bronson would be fun to have in the movie, playing a Hasidic guy. I'm trying to think. I mean, the funny thing is that we didn't have a lot of wildly different ideas. We did have a huge scene animated. We called it the billboard scene when Miles leaves the cave at Aunt May's and goes to his uncle's right afterwards. Until the very end of production, we had a scene where he went up and sat on a billboard, and Peter B. Parker went up and sat next to him, and they had like a 3 or 4 minute scene that was animated and everything that was lovely, a lovely scene between them. And that was the scene where, do you remember the line where we put it in a different scene where he says, it's a leap of faith. How do I know I'm a spider?
You know, right.
That was in that scene, and there was a lot of stuff in that scene. And we let go of it very late in the game because we didn't need it.
Because it was just pacing. It was slowing things down.
It was slowing things down. It was just saying a lot of stuff we didn't need to say, or that we could say elsewhere in a much more economical way. Again, it's like it's this process of discovering what you don't need to say. It's like, you know, often you build this like structure or chassis, you know, where everything is said, or where everything that you want to, every color is painted, and then the more into the movie you get, the more you realize you can start pulling out props, you know?
Were there any other variants that you played with other than what we now know of Noir Spider-Man, Penny Parker, Peter B. Parker, and Spider-Ham?
Essentially, no.
Okay.
Essentially, they were
so
in...
So Spider-Ham was there from the beginning?
Spider-Ham was there from the beginning. But
love
Spider-Ham
it.
Was really hard to keep in... Spider-Ham was really controversial. I'm telling you, like, the movie is not a very forgiving movie. Like, when it wasn't working, it was painful to watch.
Tell us, what was not working about Spider-Ham?
Well, with Spider-Ham, when you have a it's like Fozzie Bear. When you have a character that's joke, it can get annoying real fast. Also, when you have a movie that's, like, just in storyboards, we're screening, like, barely completed versions of the storyboard movie, you know, for audiences, and it's a really hard way to screen a movie. Again, it's really painful, you know, and sometimes it's hard to tell what is going to be good but isn't good yet. So when we would screen movies, the movie for people in a really raw form and it wasn't working, lots of people have lots of ways of trying to express to you that your movie is not working. They just fasten on whatever they can fasten on. So with Spider-Ham, you know, you get this a lot when you test screen movies. I think he was like simultaneously like the most popular and the least popular character. You know, kids loved him, parents hated him, and we did just figure it out. You know, just a war of attrition of finding the right material. And we, you know, one interesting thing about Spider-Ham is that in that scene. Remember the scene where in Miles' dorm room where they all talk about...
I was just going to bring it up. He doesn't make a joke in that scene.
Right. Yeah. So,
Everybody's talking. You're waiting for the joke from him, but right. He actually gets serious.
Right. So we animated his joke, which was like...
Which one? What was it?
You know, the way that scene went is, you know, Noir said he lost his Uncle Benjamin, and, you know, Peter lost Uncle Ben, and Gwen lost, you know...
Peter.
We went through everyone. And then Spider-Ham said he'd lost his Uncle Frankfurter... And then he said, he was electrocuted and it smelled so good. And he and he says this through like just tears. Like we actually used the shot pretty much, you know?
Because you have tears in there.
Yeah.
And then you changed what he says.
Yeah. And this was in pretty late in the game, and it always, like, I don't know how it feels when I just pitch it, but like it would destroy. Like it would get a massive laugh. People would be shocked. It was one of the biggest laughs in the movie. And we pulled it out a month or two before we wrapped, because we just decided it. We said, this is a bad laugh. Like this is throwing off the energy in the scene, and this is a time for, in general, we had this notion where we were like, Spider-Ham's a real person, you know, like with real feelings and is lonely, and you know, like we wanted the audience to get that and not, you know.
It's amazing that you took out a joke that was working so well, but you're right, because it's the scene that precedes his father coming to see him, which is really the emotional roots of the movie almost. So
we were already having trouble, you know. This movie has a lot of tonal like switchbacks, and that was already a scene where like you had this heavy, you know, Miles had just seen his uncle
lost
someone who was really important to him, and then you had this really emotional moment between all these characters where they shared their own trauma, and then you have this crazy swerve where Miles' roommate Donkey comes in and they're up on the ceiling, and that's played for comedy, and then you have another, then the end of the scene is like Miles basically getting abandoned again, so
right.
So it was, you know, so yeah. So
yeah, the only joke you let live is by Noir, where he says Uncle Benjamin.
And right. And that's debatable whether that's a joke. It's sort of a joke. But it's kind of like a character joke, you
right.
know? Yeah. And it wasn't intended as a joke. Or it kind of was. It was intended as a...
It's reminding you of the metaverse, the Spider-Verse.
Yeah, yeah.
But so were there any other tonal problems that you grappled with that were
the
tough
whole thing,
to...
The whole thing was a
really?
Tonal problem. Okay. I mean, I swear
I
to
mean,
you.
I mean, because, I mean, when you're talking about somebody like Spider-Gwen, right, mm-hmm. that you added in, I think it was really admirable that there was no sort of love relationship. There was no romance. They were really just about being friends, and she had talked about, you know, extricating friends from her life before that. Mm-hmm. So...
Yeah, but we had a version where it wasn't like that.
Really?
You know?
Tell us. What was it?
We had a version where, you know, we kind of went there.
So there was a romance version.
Sure.
How'd you know to cut it? Because I mean, like, when you're operating in a void, and that's the problem with animation, because you, yes, you're limited by your sets and your costumes and your props in that scope, but you can redub lines. You could keep changing things. How did you know in the void that the romance element was the wrong way to go?
Because it didn't feel earned at all. The reason why, because when you screen the movie for people and you go to, and you have a story move like that, and no one mentions it after the movie in the focus group, then you're like, oh, maybe we don't need that. Like, you know, maybe that feels really forced and just, it's not what we want, you know? Like, that has more to do with the setup. If we had written the setup differently or had more time or space to tell a different story, you know, a slightly different story, then maybe you could have ended it that way. But that's definitely not how that story wanted to end.
These screenings that you're talking about, you know, it's common in animation to do mm-hmm. animatics and then to do, you know, screenings of animatics or low-res versions mm-hmm. a few times during the course of production. Pixar mm-hmm. does it. Everybody does it. How many completed versions did you show during the course of your tenure?
I'd say 4 or 5.
Okay.
But there were so many screenings.
And was it friends and family, or was it...
We did friends and family. We did...
Was
recruited.
It strangers, like, recruited from a mall that was shown?
Yeah, we did that.
Materials that early?
Yeah.
Really?
Okay. Oh, sure. Yeah, you have to. It sucks, but you have to. We did it in L.A. We did it in Arizona. We did it in Texas. We did it, you know...
Okay.
On the lot a bunch of times. We did
sure.
it... we just did...
What's your view on it after doing it so many? So filmmakers are torn. A lot of filmmakers like to see how audiences are reacting, and some are not as fortunate as you guys, in which they can't recreate all the stuff they need. They would have to go do an expensive reshoot if there's a problem. So what are your views on focus groups after this? Do you eventually decide that they're okay because it lets the audience take away all the arguments that you've had behind closed doors and really just tell you in a sense if it works or not?
Yeah. I love test screenings. You know, personally, I think it's critical. But I respect that people who don't do it, if that's their process, or if they work on movies where they feel that it's not necessary. But for me, when you're working on a movie that has comedy in it, or where you want a very high level of audience engagement, you have to watch the movie with audiences, and you have to take the punch in the face.
I've interviewed Apatow before, who you've worked with, and he would actually, at his test screening, set up Zoom recorders, sound recorders that are time-coded, so that he could tell where the laughs were happening based on what cut they were watching. He was, like, making a science out of it.
Yeah, we do that.
Was there anything that came out of a focus group that you totally disagreed with, that you had to really go to the mat and fight for?
You always disagree with stuff. I mean, like, you know... But you can just tell, like, you know, and I learned this at Letterman a long time ago. It's like, I remember standing in the theater. I watched so many shows play in front of audiences, and I started to notice a difference in audience body language when they were really engaged and really, you know, if it's comedy, if they're really laughing as opposed to, like, sometimes, I don't know, something different.
Yeah, yeah.
It's different, you know. And then working on this movie, we kind of just call it, it's like, we refer to it as like leaning in, and you know that's a big Phil Lord thing. Like, you know, I was leaning in for this 45-second chunk, and then I was leaning out for like 30 minutes, and then I was leaning in for like this one little conversation, you know. And you just kind of, it's a process of just brutally redoing.
Is there an example that you want to cite of something that you really had to fight for, that you—
Everything had to be fought for.
All right.
Every, you know, so much, you know, when you have a movie like, you know, it's like the opening of the movie, you know. The runner, you know, where each spider person introduces themselves.
I was going to ask about that. And then their comic book hits the stack. That was a great framing device.
Yeah, that had to be fought for, and that didn't work. You know, when a movie's not working, it's like I said before, when a movie's not quite working, everyone has a different reason for why, you know? And anything that feels frivolous or, you know, if you're like, you know what people, you know, if a movie's not quite working and you have characters saying over and over again, let's start at the beginning one last time, like, you know.
Oh, that's got to be hell.
It's hell, and like people just want to cut it out. They're like, get that out of there. Like
what made it work? What do you think made that framing device work? It's a reminder of the meta. It's a reminder that there's more than one Spider-Man, so it works in that sense.
Just something, it's like a magical alchemy where
you just
like,
kept trying.
It just kept trying, the music, you cut stuff out, and all of a sudden, it's good.
Okay.
Yeah.
Having a bad mentor of Peter B. Parker, you know, the divorced Peter Parker that's still pining for MJ. What were your kind of decision making on that? Because it's always fun to see a bad mentor.
Yeah.
And you know, he of course has a heart. He's not evil.
Yeah.
When did you realize that was the way it was going to go?
Probably shortly after I got there. You know, a lot of that stuff was in the bones of what was there. There already was another Peter Parker who was kind of a bad mentor, but the specific flavor of who he was and what he'd been through and a lot of that stuff maybe started to come into play after Jake Johnson was cast, you know, and after we started to do even test animation of that character and kind of see what he was all about. It was pretty late in the game when we wrote his intro and we just kind of went, you know, whole hog, like, into...
He's a Spider-Man in sweatpants. It's
fantastic. Yeah, just like crying in the shower, dude.
All right. I really enjoyed Doc Ock, you know, female Doc Ock. When did you decide to arrive on that path? Because I thought it was great, and Catherine Hahn played it great. Because rather than being threatening, really, she was always just kind of cooing, like, "Oh, Spider-Man, you know, like, let me take that." Like, it was a funny interpretation.
Yeah. That was about 2 years ago when I first came on the movie. Doc Ock was male, but he was definitely not a normal Doc Ock. He was, the best comparison I could come up with is that he was almost like the Big Lebowski. Like he,
oh, really?
Yeah.
Dude Ock.
Like, yeah, kind of a dude, like hippie. Like you know, we had been into this documentary called Particle Fever, and Doc Ock and that whole Alchemax lab was kind of inspired by that. Yeah, so he was like kind of like a Caltech hippie scientist, and I think it was Bob Persichetti, one of my co-directors, who when I was first on the movie as a writer, had this notion of it being a woman, and then I kind of ran with that.
Tell us about the scene where the Prowler's killed, where Miles faces off with Uncle Aaron, because it was a great scene, and you could have gone a bunch of different ways. How did you arrive at that intimate moment, literally him hanging off a roof in his uncle's hands and pulling up his mask?
You know, just some of these answers are kind of boring, but you know, I mean, that plot point was in it was probably in Phil's treatment. You know, like it was that was definitely there when I got there. And then the specifics of that scene just kind of were just carved out over many versions. You know, I definitely like the idea that Miles would get really quiet in that moment. Always I liked that though. Always, you know, the more we made the movie, the more we wanted our performers to be quiet, you know, because we were seeing what the animators were doing with very restrained or kind of naturalistic performances. So yeah, you just kind of want to boil it down in a moment like that, you know, or his death scene, you know, I don't know. Like
it was great. Cause I mean, for as busy as the movie is, you're going in a minimalist style in that sense where there's just a level of intimacy,
which
I thought was fantastic, which leads us to the scene with him and his dad at the door.
Yeah.
You know, like I could see that going a lot of different ways and it was great. You know, like he's rolling around on the chair and you know, he's literally becoming his version of Spider-Man right after that scene.
Mm-hmm.
So tell us about kind of those two scenes linked together. And of course, please, the poetry of just jumping out and like, you know, going upside down in slow motion was just, it's just a beautiful sequence, a beautiful shot, but starting with his dad.
Yeah. I mean, that scene came pretty fast. You know, like we had tried various versions of, we had a version where Aunt May kind of said something, kind of played that part at that moment. Then we decided that it really needed to be his dad. That scene itself was written late at night pretty fast and didn't change that much. Partially because we recorded it very soon after with Brian, and he just did such a great job that we were done. I don't know, man. Like sometimes that stuff, I don't say it comes easy, but you just like put yourself in the,
you're in the zone.
You're in the zone. I have a son, you know, I have a dad. I, you know, went through periods of my life where we didn't talk much. And you know, that's the stuff I really honestly thought about what I want, you know, something I would say to my son or something that I would want my dad to say to me or, and it came fast.
Yeah. And the sequence of him becoming, per se, any great memories of creating that? Because it's an amazing sequence.
Yeah, I mean, you know, one detail there I would say is that shot you're talking about of him, you know, the wide shot of him falling. You know, I mean, we built that for a teaser trailer. You know, that's another thing with this movie is that like we had to build a teaser trailer like a year and change ago, and we didn't have a movie. You know, we kind of had a movie, but like,
that's crazy,
you know, but we learned a lot about the movie and what it was going to look like by building shots for the teaser trailer. That shot was built for the teaser trailer, but from a very early draft, Phil, from the first draft that I read, Phil had this sentence in there. He very specifically called out that in that scene, Miles was falling and rising at the same time. That's how he put it. And that's what that shot is. It's him falling and rising at the same time.
It's beautiful.
Yeah.
The ending. Tell us about how your action looked on the page and for a scene so complicated in which in the Spider-Verse itself with subways, trains, mm-hmm. buildings flying at you, tell us how you map that out because it seems really complicated.
Yeah.
But you did it in the easiest fashion and then you have, again, reduction in which everybody's going back to their different dimensions mm-hmm. and it's just Miles and the Kingpin.
Yeah, so that, I mean, the third act was built last, was written for sure, but we did not have the luxury of like, you know, that was like basically written fast and then built in storyboards and layout and, you know, all hands on deck type, you know, approach, you know, which is all writing, you know.
Of course.
That's just how that, you know, it was such a visual concept anyway. You know, I mean, the idea of like deconstructing, you know, the visual language of our movie kind of, and of crashing together different dimensions, you know, we just debated it until the last possible minute before we could, you know, go with something. But that definitely is what felt right. It was scary to go with that because until we had those shots, like, lit and, you know, rendered to some extent, they looked just, you know, you couldn't really tell what was happening. And, you know, but I kind of look back on that really fondly and proudly, like the moment where we committed to that third act, because there wasn't full support for that idea. Like we really just
Was supported? What was the third act you were going to have?
It's not that there was any alternative, and that was by design. Like
okay,
you know, we were at the end of the process. We wanted to end in a way that topped ourselves and that kind of paid off the movie visually. Everyone that we were working with, our production designer, all our crew, were down and were excited, and we just like put a brick on the pedal and went. And, you know, and hope that it would make sense, you know. And then, you know, within all that chaos, you have these very key emotional scenes that are built like normal scenes, you know.
Right. His dad cheering for him, even though he doesn't know it's his son, was the perfect way to go. And and he gets up, which is what Spider-Man always does. So
exactly. Yeah. But goodbye scenes or moments between characters, you know, there are a couple moments where dialogue is being, you know, said when they're moving or fighting, but you know, you'll notice that a lot of the important stuff is
stationary
or done in little quiet places, and that's not just so you can focus on it, it's also because we needed to, like, you know, because of how we made that third act, we needed to plant flags for the important stuff because we didn't know what was going to be happening in between.
I'm curious about the end tag, you know, going back to 1967 and having Spider-Man 2099, I thought was fantastic.
Yes.
It sets up ways that you could go for a sequel. Was that always in the mix, or did that come in late as well?
That came in really late, like real late, like October late.
October 18? Wow.
Yeah. We just wrote it and did it fast. We cast Oscar Isaac. We recorded him over FaceTime. You know, with me playing 1967 Spider-Man, and we did have another idea for a coda that we were excited about, but we couldn't get it.
What was it?
I don't know if I can say.
Were there other versions that you guys had toyed with, like, you know, using the voices of Tom Holland and tying into the things that are going on now, or, you know, Tobey Maguire or Andrew Garfield or Neil Patrick Harris or even Electric Company Spider-Man?
Yes. I wrote a scene that had Tom Holland and Andrew Garfield and Tobey Maguire in the same scene. And
what were they doing? Were they just around and then they left?
I don't want to get into it. But but I did write that scene. But there was a lot of anxiety. There was a lot of anxiety around the movie generally. And there was anxiety about confusing people. Let's put it that way.
I understand. Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah. What was your toughest scene? What was the scene that you kept coming back to again and again as a writer and as a director?
Yeah.
And because it doesn't have to be the same scene. And how did you creatively rise to the challenge? And then we'll get a question or two from the crowd.
Okay. The hardest scenes are kind of the most boring scenes. The hardest scenes are the pipe, like, or like, you know. But
take us into the process. It's not boring at all.
The middle. Like, you know, once you meet Peter B. Parker, you know, on the punching bag, you know. There's a scene, you know, there's a scene where they're walking down the building, they're in the diner. That whole sequence was that was maybe the sequence we did the most.
Interesting. Did you feel it was a pacing issue, or?
It was just like, those were scenes that were designed to carry exposition and to get a lot of boring story stuff across, and doing it in a way that wasn't boring.
You made it funny. They were at the restaurant that closed 6 years ago in Peter B. Parker's universe.
Yeah,
so
it was just
you had
hard.
Jokes going.
I'm just telling you, like, it was.
What
it
were some of the iterations that were
it's slowing more like, you down? It's more like what the exposition was. Like,
so it's the villain of exposition, which plagues all writers.
Yeah, you think you have to say everything in a perfect way, and when and then we're playing it on boards and it just feels boring and your mind checks out. You're like, oh, they just said a lot of stuff. I can't remember a single thing they just said. That's not good. I guess we haven't found the perfect combination of words yet, so let's try again. It was just challenging.
So that's as a writer. What's the scene as a director that really challenged you?
those. You know, you know, meeting the spiders was really hard. That whole scene, you know, and then they have to go home, and Miles says he can do it, and then they test him. That was another sequence where we just tried. We had lots of additional material we thought we needed. We felt we needed to do a lot of stuff with all the characters and different subplots, and it just got lengthy. And
do you want to give us an example of the different subplots?
Subplots. It was just kind of like
Please tell us Noir Spider-Man solved a crime.
No, it wasn't like that. You know,
or fight some Nazis, maybe.
This is something interesting. You know, throughout the movie, I would say we went through periods where we would have a lot more conflict. You know? So when Peter B. Parker showed up, we'd have a lot more conflict between him and Miles. You know, the angry, the couple that hates each other when they first meet, you know, or when the spiders all got together, we'd have a lot of conflict between them, you know. Characters used to working alone who are vying for, you know.
Right, and that's something Spider-Gwen and all of them say, like, you know, they're not used to having a friend.
Yeah, so we, you know, and what we found with this movie is that you didn't want to watch these characters fight that much. You know, it almost was like a weird, I wouldn't say bold, but it was like a weird gutsy choice for us to be like, kind of like, you know what, they're kind of going to like each other. You know, they'll have conflict.
I mean,
like,
Spider-Ham would win, so it would just be boring for everyone to see.
Yeah, you just kind of, Miles is such a sweet character. He's so likable, and you're so with him that in some ways you didn't want to watch people yell at him, like, you know, or fight with him, or you didn't want to watch him fight with other people. You wanted people to want to take him under, you know, it felt better to have people want to help him, but they just were not capable. Peter B. Parker is not capable of helping him, but deep down he wants to.
Right, and for all the spider people that like working alone, like, Miles wants to be a part of what they're a part of, and he's just on the cusp, he's just on the edge.
Yeah, so. it's just not right, it's too dangerous, it's just, you know, they want him to, they're rooting for him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We're going to take a question or two from the crowd, right here in the front row, you, sir. The question was regards to killing off the Green Goblin in the beginning, such a big part of the spider universe itself. Was that kind of just to make room for the female Doc Ock and to show us that things are going to be really different here?
I think it was more the latter. You know, I think it was more just trying to convey to the audience that, you know, the goal of everything is to be subjective to Miles and to get the audience to feel what he's feeling. So if we're showing you a scene where Miles is scared and shocked, then we want to kind of shock the audience so that they feel that anything can happen, you know?
Couple other cues. I'm going to go all the way in the back. You, sir, in the hat. Having the five spiders, how did you try and give them each their individual moments and pacing throughout the film? Because I could see them competing for time, but they seemed like an organic unit, was what he was saying.
Yeah. It's going to be repetitive and boring, but our big epiphany was just the more this runs through Miles, the more they're all interacting with Miles and not like trying to draw your focus to some other thing, the more everyone's in the same scene, the better off we were, and the more they stayed in the movie. Because when we wrote the characters in ways where they were, you know, trying to pull focus, you got annoyed.
But I will say, Noir Spider-Man trying to solve a Rubik's Cube or even understand
wonderful.
It was beautiful.
Wonderful.
Right there, you, ma'am. Her question was regarding Dakota and how it came together so fast. Obviously, you were using part of it from 1967 animation Spider-Man. That's a famous scene. But obviously, you also have 2099 Spider-Man. So was it difficult to get in that fast? Because since you did in October, it would almost suggest that Australian Spider-Man could have been possible. That's all I'm saying.
That's a great point. One of our unfortunate takeaways from the movie, to the dismay of everyone we worked with, was that when they say you can't work past X date, that's not true. You can. I'm not kidding at all. That was true. But
what was your X date? What was your delivery date?
It was just always something.
Okay.
You know, like you'd be surprised. Apparently, you can finish a movie that comes out in December in December. That's what we
really?
Learned.
Really?
That's what we learned.
When was the final DCP mastered?
In December.
Wow.
Yeah.
Good for you, sir. Good for you. Fighting the good fight.
That was gnarly. That's the, you know, it was just, you know, it was last minute. I think we've animated to scratch some. you know, we still ended up adding some stuff. We kind of, I wouldn't say improvised with Oscar Isaac. We still expanded some stuff, or, you know, but we, in the end, yeah, I think we animated that quite a bit to scratch.
Okay. Yeah. Right here in the second row, you, sir. What was your favorite scene? Your funniest moment that you really loved?
I mean, my favorite scene is the scene with the dad at the door. It just is. I mean, there's a lot of scenes that I like. I don't mean that in like a...
Well, that's clearly your most personal scene, yeah, for sure.
You know, but you know, when you work on something so, you know, in such a collaborative way as this, with so many people who are putting... Yeah, and I'm not just talking about co-directors, and I'm not just talking about Phil and Chris. I'm talking about like hundreds of crazy talented artists who did amazing work. So when you work on that, you have this, you know, for me watching the movie, it's this weird thing of feeling both like a director of it and also a spectator, you know, like it's just a weird mix when I watch it. So that's my favorite scene. Funniest scene, gosh, man. I tend to fasten on like dumb thing, you know, like, you know, it's not about a funny scene. It's about like weird little details or something. And now I can't even think of an example.
Okay. We'll go for another question. Yeah. You, sir, right here in the sweater. How is directing an animated feature different from live feature directing, which you haven't yet done? But
well, I've worked on a bunch, though.
Of course. But which do you prefer, he was also saying.
Yeah.
So the difference, because you're still directing actors and voiceover, but also which you prefer.
It's way different, man. It's like, you know, an animated movie, it's like you're in like pre-production, production, and post-production at the same time for years. And you have, and these things can run differently depending on your budget or your schedule, but like, you know, you have so many opportunities to, you're making the movie as you go, you know? There's also a real downside to that because, you know, you can always keep working on stuff or, you know, it's just, you know, whereas with a live action movie, you kind of like, press record once, you know, you might have reshoots, but you know, on the day you get what you get. And that's also can be really exciting and you get adrenaline, you know, from that. I like them both. I'd say right now I'm a little more, I like them both and I want to work on both, but I'm really psyched on animation right now. I'm really psyched on what you can do.
You know, we're basically out of time. What could you tell us that you're working on next? I know you're working on something called The Something, if I have. Or is that incorrect?
It's kind of incorrect. I wrote a script called The Something a number of years ago that is like a space kind of horror comedy.
What's the concept of it exactly?
It's about four men on a tiny spaceship with a really shitty job, basically in like a 300 square foot spaceship, and they haven't seen anybody in years, and they come across another ship that has a secret, and it's a big massive ship, and there's it's crewed by some women, and there's a movie called Dark Star. Have you ever heard of it?
Of course. Classic.
It was kind of. I worked on a movie with Harold Ramis about 10 years ago, and he gave me Dark Star, and there was a short story I once read by a writer called Houston. Can you read me? I can't remember. These things kind of inspire this thing. So I might do that. But I wrote a Jump Street movie that they might make.
Right.
But the truth is, I'm like pretty. Pumped on this and
on animation. I hope you do more.
Yeah.
Look, you've been very generous with your time. I love Spider-Verse. I cannot wait to see what you do next. Give it up again for Rodney.
Thank you.
And that's how the Q&A went down. Special thanks again to co-writer director Rodney Rothman for coming down to chat about his latest film, Spider-Man: Into the Spider-Verse. You know, at one point during the podcast, Rodney and I discussed some script pages that were really funny that he shared with us for the article in Backstory Magazine about a scene that was never created but is quite hilarious. And I've decided to share those pages with everybody, so you could just hop on over to backstory.net and you could read those script pages whenever you like. Of course, don't forget to visit our sponsor, the fine folks at ScreenCraft, and save 10% off your application fee at screencraft.org by using code QAPodcast. Podcast, all one word, SQAPodcast@screencraft.org, and you could save 10% on your application to the Screencraft Film Fund, or even a chance to win the Screencraft Screenwriting Fellowship and sign with a top agency. So don't forget to type in QAPodcast@screencraft.org to save 10% when you apply. And folks, we recently published issue 35 of Backstory Magazine, and it features a Vice cover story with writer-director Adam McKay chatting about his truly original screenplay. Plus, issue 35 also has in-depth articles on Aquaman, Mary Poppins Returns, Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse, and our huge Nickel Fellowship piece where we meet the 2018 winners, plus so much more. So I hope you look at the table of contents so you can see everything that's inside issue 35. And if you like what you see, I hope you consider subscribing. If you're on the fence, you could read issue number 1, the free issue, and test drive us at backstory.net as well. So I hope you'll check it out. And hey, if you're in LA, you're going to visit LA, make sure to sign up for my screening series so you could come to these events, as we're happy to have you. You could sign up to get on the free email list at backstory.net/events, so I hope to see you at a screening sometime soon. The Q&A with Jeff Goldsmith is a copyright of Unlikely Films Incorporated in 2019. All rights reserved. And hey, if you'd like to show your support and donate to this free podcast so I can continue to buy new equipment and use these funds to pay all of my podcast hosting fees, feel free to send a PayPal virtual tip to yogoldsmith@gmail.com. Any amount is greatly appreciated. As for your social networking needs, you could follow Yo Goldsmith on Twitter or could check out my Facebook fan page. I'm Jeff Goldsmith, the publisher of Backstory and the host of the Q&A, thanking you for tuning in and telling you to stay out of trouble. Till next week.